Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Ewan Paterson, what is the best flavoured crisp on the earth right now?
Oh, shoot, from the hit, mate. I mean, you know, I've got to shout out my old timer, which is like the Doritos Chili Heatwave.
Can't go wrong
with those. They're pretty great. But I'm also a big Ridged Crisp fan.
Just a big ridge.
You know those paprika Walkers ones that you can get? Which is like, they are fabulous. And then, yeah, Pringles hurt me, mate. I used to have like a really bad Pringle problem, which is a really funny set of words to say together in order.
They're addictive. There's legit something in them.
They hurt your insides, man. They tear them up. So I've had to forsake the Pringle life.
You know when you have like a whole tube of the salt and vinegar and your mouth just sort of becomes like a cat's arse, and it's just like, what is this?
Because I'm terrible. I just go for, like, I know everyone swears by the is it the sour cream and chive one?
Yeah.
The default salty Pringles, just I've had them many a time, and we had good memories together, and I had to call it quits to the relationship.
Had the Paul Walker song on and see you again.
Yeah, except instead of Paul Walker, it's a tube of Pringles going off the other side of the road.
They popped and then he stopped. For now, though, this has been the Entitled. This is the beginning of the Entitled Podcast.
It's already over. Goodbye, everyone.
This is all you get, Ewan. This is the UBP. The Entitled Banner Podcast. I'm Scott Tilford. That's Ewan Paterson.
It is. Hello, everyone.
Hello. First time. Thank you so much for diving on. Every single week, I never know whether Jules is available or not. Man, let me know during the week how many other meetings and guest appearances and whatever the hell he's got going on, he has going on. And so thank you so much, you and genuinely, for dropping in here. And we had so many awesome questions, because every single week we ask people to submit whatever they'd like us to talk about, whether it be gaming things or whatever else is going on in the industry, in their lives, in the crisp world. It doesn't matter. We'll get through as many different things as we can. So first question from George Jackson, who says, "Ahoy, lads. What's your thoughts on studios like Naughty Dog not giving any info on new games at all? They only released two new games across the 2010s, both absolutely stellar titles, but it's a shame to see such a great studio go radio silent. Also, Demolition Man is amazing, Ewan."
I know George is a patron of the Wheel of Dad Movies podcast, which is very nice of him. And yeah, our Demolition Man chat, man. That's an irreconcilable divide we have made there.
Yeah, we've driven a wedge amongst the populace. But go check out Ewan's We Love Dad Movies podcast, where me and him debated the majesty that is Demolition Man, the perfect movie that is. But yeah, in regards to like release slates and stuff, this question comes in amongst all the chat about the layoffs over at Naughty Dog. There's a lot of external contractors that were apparently working on The Last of Us Factions multiplayer game, the live service game, whatever the hell that thing was going to be. Various staff members have been let go for that, and the latest conversation around that is that the game has actually been cancelled altogether, but it's very much in the rumour stage. But that general idea of a certain echelon of game studio kind of keeping all their cards close to their chest, where do you come down on that? I want way more openness. I would prefer making of documentaries every week. I would check in with the studios, whatever. I can only recommend the likes of Double Fine Adventure and the studios that have put fly on the wall calm stuff out there, but it's always post-launch. But I would always welcome more openness and honesty into the realities of making a game, because it sounds impossible.
I was going to say, I wonder if it's just part and parcel of the way that the industry is now, that it's impossible for gaming studios to be more transparent, because we know that there's so much tumult. And, you know, we talked about in the Wind Up podcast earlier this week about how, like, the Last of Us Factions multiplayer game had been put on ice, and now you're saying that it's probably been cancelled. It's probably a reason why studios like Naughty Dog, or even a Rocksteady or Warner Brothers Montreal or whatever, I always go between them, because obviously we know over the past eight years... 8 years that it's been since Arkham Knight, and the 10 years it's been since Arkham Origins, that numerous games over those at those studios got cancelled. We know that because we've had, you know, seasoned industry reporters like Jason Schreier talk about the cancellations. So it's difficult. I think it's one of those situations where, because game development is so volatile, we're all absolutely begging for more information, and we want to know and be kept abreast of what's actually going on, because radio silence doesn't inspire the best of confidence at times, and it can be quite frustrating. But at the same time, if they announce stuff early, you get situations like the Knights of the Republic remake, where they announced it and they had the big trailer and there was loads of fanfare behind it, and it seems as if that project's been cancelled too. Yeah. I think this is more an issue with regards to ballooning development times, and the fact that we're waiting so long for games to get made now, that there is more risk in being open and transparent as a studio. It's very frustrating. I think it's just the nature of game dev.
That's now a really good point, that like it's almost like they don't want to let anybody know what's coming, because they can't even guarantee it's actually going to get there at all. Like, I always think of the likes of Scalebound, the amount of positive general reception conversation that was around that game way back on the Xbox One, and it just didn't make it. We had gameplay demos, we had trailers, we had everything. You know, and Fable Legends as well, like, that game was being played at press events and everything, and then for whatever reason it just got canned. Yeah, there's a whole mess of issues regarding the production budgets and the reality of how long these things take. And we mentioned it on the earlier podcast across the week about, like, you know, when something gets greenlit now, and it was Jason Schreier saying it, that you're sort of planning games for the next generation of consoles, which is ludicrous. The fact that Rocksteady, until you just said that there, I forgot it had been 8 years since Arkham Knight. The fact that we've not had anything else from them, and the next game is the Suicide Squad Life Savers game, which seems like it's going to die anyway, is just a massive shame. So yeah, for me, it's a wish list thing. I would want a massive overhaul of how much money gets put into these projects. And it's one of those things where I'm looking at a movie like The Creator, which is currently doing the rounds of something that's been budgeted very, very well. It's being held up against the bigger movies that do the rounds, the MCUs, the DCs, everything else, as a way to do a gorgeous looking movie, a top tier looking movie, for a fraction of the cost. And you would hope that gaming gets there as well. Because I just want these creatives to put more stuff out. I would much rather have 5 smaller games from Naughty Dog staffers and Naughty Dog creators than one every sort of 6 years or whatever it is. Exactly. And like, same with Rockstar.
Like, yeah, Rockstar, I was going to say as well, with Red Dead Redemption 2, again, my favorite game of all time, an absolute labor of love, a masterpiece that was crafted over many, many, many years. However, at the same time, even though I would love a Red Dead Redemption 3 that is just as big and as detailed and as, you know, infinite in scope as that game, I'd also much rather have, like, loads of little Red Dead Redemptions. Like, you could have done a smaller Sadie Adler spin-off, you could have done this and that. People say, oh, maybe they'd be milking it at that point and you'd get bored of it, but I think there is a point in time at the minute, you know, stoked by conversations around games like AC Mirage, where I do wonder if people become more aware of the process of, well, there's a happy medium, isn't there, between, like, annualized games that come out all the time and, like, with very little innovation between them, like the FIFAs or the FC24s now, or the Call of Duties or whatever, and the really long, you know, AAA titles that take forever. I think we're just in a situation now where it's almost like we're reaching a critical mass of how big these games are, and at what point does the industry and studios and publishers, how much money are they willing to put up front for a game that they're not going to see their investment returned on for nearly a decade? You know, it's no other industry, I feel, entertainment industry, I feel, is working like that currently. No. They're getting their profit turnarounds much more quickly. And I'm not sure that the industry has reckoned with that at the minute, because it still must be working, obviously, and that's why you're getting more live service games, so they can tick over the funds in the meantime between entries coming out. But yeah, it seems as if it's there is a ruction waiting to happen with all this.
It feels like there's a hope that if we do put all of this money into this massive long production cycle and we have all this marketing and all this hype and whatever else, that it all pays off and everyone goes home at the end and they never make anything ever again. Like in regard, and especially on the shareholder side, it's like, oh, we cashed in, we did really well. And they're not in it for the creative side anyway from the beginning. But yeah, it's one of those things where the amount of money that circles these projects, and we see them, so many of them go sideways. Like the likes of Cyberpunk, even though that game has recovered, quote unquote, especially in regards to the new critical response, the DLC, and things, it was revealed that they lost, well, they spent $125 million trying to get it back on track again, and their investor value is way down for CDPR. And it's like that overall conversation of like, this could have all been avoided based on better managerial decisions. I know it's not a live service game, but that game's multiplayer has largely been cancelled, which would have been their live service continuation of all the mechanics and everything. But I think it's one of those things where the industry has chased the tech industry for a while, like shinier graphics, better rendering, greater physics, mechanics, etc., which I do want, but they've not really made it manage along the way. And I think we're hitting such a weird point at the minute where like the last couple of weeks or the last month or so has been dominated by layoffs, just various stories about studio layoffs and just the amount of people that were brought on board across the pandemic to do even bigger games. It's not sustainable. For me, I don't know if it's just the nostalgia or whatever, but I feel like the industry I grew up with was in a healthier state. And you mentioned Mirage before. We have a couple of questions about that, and I've been playing it, and we'll get to them. But something like Mirage is, at least to me, proof that not everything needs to be a 100, 200 hour game. You can just do a game for a reasonable price point, and it can be over in a weekend, and that's okay. Like, it doesn't need to take up the rest of your life or the rest of a couple of months or something. Those games can exist too, but not everything needs to be that. Next question from Dan Taylor, who says, "Hi lads, I recently started playing GTA 4 for the first time. While I'm loving it so far, the driving is definitely not to my taste. With this in mind, has a single mechanic ever stopped you from enjoying an entire game?" I was trying to think of a pun there for a mechanic NPC that got in the way, but I can't think of one, so it's going to have to be an actual game mechanic. I will back the GTA 4 thing, though. I don't know where you came down on that discourse at the time, but like I hated the driving in GTA 4. It didn't put me off the game altogether, but I never got on board with it. How
honestly
squirrely it all was.
Right, I didn't... having played GTA 5, where the driving is obviously so much better and crisp and buttery smooth and stuff and more responsive, I totally understand why people would not like the driving in GTA 4. However, the floatiness of the vehicles in GTA 4 lets you do really fun cinematic like drifts. That's around true. Corners and like classic like Friedkin-esque like French Connection car chases where you're like, so I do kind of like that, even if it is way too bouncy and floaty. There is definitely a game out there which has caused me enough frustration because I didn't like one specific thing about it. I think I bounced off Shadow of War very quickly due to the army management stuff where you had to like, where back when it first came out, I remember being so excited for that game, playing it, and before they excised all the microtransaction-y stuff, I saw all of that and I was like, you've literally turned which was a very streamlined, really well-polished, well-made open-world game. You've introduced a bunch of grindy mechanics which just weren't for me at all. I completely bounced off that.
Orc loot boxes, my friend.
And I still haven't come back to that since they fixed it all, which I know I really should do, but I literally was so upset that I traded it in like a month after buying it.
See, that game, like, I beat it up at the main story, and it was like, I never done any of the end game stuff, because that was where the grind really came in, because it was just incentivizing you to pay your way through to get the best army to do those mini games and everything. But I still think that game's mechanics, like the guts of how the AI works and the guts of how it generates enemies based on how you kill them and everything, I think that stuff is so cool.
Oh,
and it
hell
sucks
yeah.
that Monolith didn't do anything else with it, or weren't able to, because I know it was like patented and everything from the top down. Like, assumedly their Wonder Woman game will be the next version of that, where you're turning people and things like that, but it's been so long. We talked about Rocksteady before. Monolith, I mean, Shadow of Mordor was 2014, Shadow of War was 2017.
2014?
So I know! It's kind of ridiculous. In terms of something that just I couldn't vibe with, there was a new game called Fort Solace, which should have been everything. I ranted about it in some other podcasts, but that game, it forces you to walk everywhere, and it's one of those things where it's only about 4 hours long, if that, anyway. And I don't know if the devs were just like, look, if anyone does anything more than a saunter, they're going to finish this in about 20 minutes. So they just make you walk everywhere, even when threats are kicking off, even when you've got to save a character or get away from something or whatever. And it's not necessarily a mechanic, but they enforce it so much. And the way that game's map works, it's all really slow animations and everything. It's like if Red Dead 2's camp pacing was a whole game, it's that. And after a while, I was like, I totally get what you're going for. And the art direction is gorgeous, but this thing is painful to play. It was a slog to get through.
I actually have a more accurate response to this one as well. When the LEGO games introduced their dynamic split screen. Like, I used to love the LEGO games when they were like, you both shared this screen together. And I remember when LEGO Indiana Jones 2 came out, and I loved the first LEGO Indiana Jones, probably my favorite LEGO game. I mean, I love LEGO Batman 2 as well. I think those two are my two favorites. But when they introduced dynamic split screen, I just remember playing it with my dad, and we were both so disoriented by this rotating screen.
It would rotate.
And it's so annoying because they've largely kept that since. I think the Skywalker saga was different, where it's like you just had two like split screens in general. So obviously the whole idea with that is that you're not restricting people. You don't have to walk with your mate to go everywhere. But I think that was fine. I didn't have an issue with that. Like, I thought it was fine to be stuck in the similar spot on the levels. I know maybe it opens up more game design aspects to them, which would make sense to me if they had online co-op as well, because then you could actually like do that with other people and you wouldn't be restricted by the screen space. But definitely when LEGO Indiana Jones 2 came out, I jumped out of that immediately because of the split screen. We couldn't crack it.
Yeah, my thing is, like, it depends. Like, if the core of what I'm doing is satisfying, I can largely put up with quite a lot. Like, I played all of Anthem and finished that game's whole story. Like, it was just it's just certain things. Like, mine tends to not necessarily be a specific mechanic. It tends to be like they roadblock a story point and I hate when any game, and Zelda used to always do this, where it's just sort of like, okay, then you're right at the end of the game, there's five more fetch quests, go find the five items and to make the key to get through the door to talk to the dude that you want to do the thing. I hate stuff like that, if that's sort of like general setup for things. Question from Jack Asbury, who says, I know he's been back a while, but I just want to say it's great seeing and hearing you. And again, what brought you back to WoW culture?
Oh,
other than me kidnapping you with a giant burlap sack.
Yeah, Scott literally bundled me in the back of his mystery machine.
You can't get away. You can't get away.
That's a really nice thing to say. Thank you. On that question, as far as I can like actually like say and stuff, I definitely miss the video side of things. So I left WoW culture in 2021, which people have been keeping up on my social media will know that was kind of a wild year for me. It wasn't a great year. Lots of not fun stuff happened. My dad passed away, and there was just loads of like COVID lag. We were still kind of working from home and not really.
Oh yeah,
there was lots of stuff going on there. And I think for me at the time, I needed to get more experience wider in the industry because WoW culture was my first job. I went away and did that. I also needed to kind of think to myself, like, what is it that I actually want to do? Am I a comics person? Am I a gaming person? Am I a film person? And over the course of like the last couple of years, I basically gained some valuable perspective, realized that I missed the video side of things a great deal, missed working with my friends as well. And the way it just shook out, it worked out pretty well. I think there are certain changes that have been made and other stuff. So yeah, I think in general, it just made sense to come back because yeah. And right now I'm like super happy. I'm working on like doing film for the main channel, and film is like, I've kind of realize is like my main big passion because I've been burnt out on superheroes quite a lot recently. Oh, God, and yes. I didn't fancy the idea of going back into that world. And I can still do gaming stuff on the side because I have my little niches within gaming. So the current situation is working out quite nice. I genuinely just think it was a case of like your tastes as a person change over time. Totally. And I couldn't really, just superheroes and comic books, and then also Star Wars. It's just, I'm so burnt out on that stuff. There are still certain things that I'll enjoy, like Star Wars Jedi Survivor, which is obviously an amazing time. Obviously, like, you know, I'll have a space in my heart for the old stuff too. But I think it just, yeah, like, film was the thing that I want to focus on. An opportunity opened up here to do that again. And
he climbed back into the sack himself.
Yeah, and there's the office as well, which is fantastic. And yeah, it's it feels. Yeah, no. Without going like massively off the deep end about why, it's just like it just made sense is the short answer.
Yeah. Also, I absolutely love you, and I was so glad to have you back. And things like this are lush. And yeah, also shout out to Josh Brown. Like, the ability for you to hop on things is mainly because Josh is taking some time off, but you was the first person I asked and wanted to have on to help out with the pods, help out with the videos, news, etc. And yeah, it's lush. I mean, we go back like 10 years now. It's been a long while since we were first in touch. Maybe nine years.
It's eight. 8 years. 8 years.
So it was, you were still in uni, and then it was like
the beginning of 2015. It was 2015.
Right, yeah, because you were covering Arkham Knight and everything. But, like, yeah, that was way back when you were still in uni and, like, I was still building the channel and everything. And so I, like, circulated an email around and we got in touch and then it was like, Ewan's awesome at everything. Can we please get him on board? And then everything came together after that. So, yeah, man, it's been awesome to have you back. Like, genuinely, it's lush. Aww. Question from Matthew McGowan, who says, in general, do you prefer chonky, weighty, heavy combat that feels impactful but risks being slow or boring, Dark Souls, God of War 2018, or fluid, smooth combat that feels graceful but risks being floaty or weightless, Ninja Gaiden, Devil May Cry, or Spider-Man?
Oh, see, I think Spidey's combat feels punchy. I think it depends on how, how it's implemented. Like, Batman Arkham is very fluid and stuff, but the way the vibrations and the control and everything and the animation and the noise design and everything, the way when you make impact, that still feels punchy to me.
To me, it's worlds away from the Soulsian trend, though.
Oh, like, yeah. I think it's honestly, for me, it's a matter of like how it's executed, kind of like in terms of presentation. If you can make the floaty stuff feel punchy, if you like feel the sword entering the enemy's guts and like you hear all the viscera and stuff.
But 19 inches of viscera.
I guess I yes. I do enjoy the slower stuff too, though. Like, I think there's a methodical satisfaction that comes from learning an enemy's set patterns and being patient, figuring out how to do things. Mm-hmm. I guess, yeah, the satisfaction for me is more derived from, like, the presentation side of things than necessarily being a god and being able to wipe out a set of people or have to be really methodical and cautious and stuff. I don't know.
For me, where I am right now, and I've played all the Souls games, all the spin-offs, everything else, I am sick to death of that model. And I think overall, like, I'm a Matrix kid. I'm a slow motion wall flipping, like, give me all the fun moves kid. So like, I want to take out a platoon of enemies in a really cool, fancy way. And then I want to stand at the end, sheath the sword, and they all fall over at the same time or something like that. Like, I'm into that stuff. So like, give me DMCs, Ninja Gaidens. I love all the different moves that you get in Spider-Man. So I prefer the latter in this case. I love acrobatics and athleticism in combat models. I want to be able to show off. Like, I want to have a definitive sort of arc from when I started as a character and maybe a few hours in where I'm more comfortable and I'm putting more flair into my combat and everything. But it's just because I was raised on movies that had loads of slow motion in. I'm loving Mission Impossible too. Like, I'm that guy. So it's I always love that stuff. And I feel like as much as the Dark Souls stuff, the God of War, the over-the-shoulder thing has its place and has kind of reminded a lot of developers to make really meaningful encounters, especially one-on-one stuff, I'm personally a bit sick of it. And I think one of the telltale signs that it doesn't necessarily fully work was in God of War. They had to map a 180 spin button to like down on the D-pad. And it's like, because if the camera's that tight, you just can't manage the groups of enemies that well. And after a while, I'm like, I want to put the sword behind my back and block the thing that's coming in. Then I want to whirl around and do cool stuff. And it's like, sometimes you just can't do that. Or at least no developers really honed that in the Dark Souls model. So it's, I think there's a game coming up called, I think it's Phantom Blade Zero, that seems to mesh the two a little bit. In the trailer, it was very Soulsian, but then they did have group fights and things like that. I love, and you'll remember, the X-Men Origins, X-Men Origins Wolverine, X2 Wolverine's Revenge.
Yes.
When you could take on like three dudes at once or four dudes at once if you were positioned right. And I'm like, I love stuff like that.
I think Jedi Survivor does that really well, where you have like obviously the Souls influences, but you can still take on multiple people confidently once you've gotten to grips with the mechanics. And like, you know, if you mix in the different stances together, you can like integrate crowd control or you can take on a bunch of droids at the same time and stuff. So that works better to me. There's definitely, I think there's a balance, isn't there?
There's always a thing in Souls games about like lock-on etiquette as well. Like, you do want to be locking on and de-locking to go between groups or go to single enemies and stuff. There's always a way to do it. But yeah, overall, I'll take flippy, ridiculous, over-the-top stuff as much as possible. Question from Paul McSoul, who says, first off, hope everyone enjoyed the wedding. Secondly, which we should shout out, massive shout out to Rich Hudson and now Amy Hudson for finally getting married. Rich Hudson, one of the most valuable members of the channel over the last 10 years. Dude's over at Frontier Games doing his dream job, working all the roller coasters and everything.
I don't think I could have more happiness for one man.
I'm not going to lie, man. I teared up twice. It was like Rich's vow bit and Amy's bit. I was like, you know, when you're just so happy the two people are together, it's beautiful. Shout out to them. Go find them on social media, Rich Hudson, over on Twitter/X, and give them a shout out. But McSoul says, in honor of young Richard, what is the best, or who are the best married couple in gaming? Now, this is an interesting question. Hardly any people are actually fully married in gaming. Most of the time, they get together at the end. I'm going to go with Geralt and Yennefer but I know they're not like formally married, but they're very much a married couple. especially by the end of The Witcher 3. I guess it depends who you pick, but I went full Yennefer.
The best married couple in gaming is my Skyrim wife, because she puts up with so much. Nate and Elena from
Uncharted. Yes, I couldn't think there. Nathan and Elena.
As someone who doesn't really care for the first two Uncharted games, I think the way their relationship is presented in the fourth game. Yeah, that's pretty good depiction of marriage in games. I really like that one.
I quite like for that as well. And that whole initial trilogy, they held back on them like making out and being over the top, and it's all will they, won't they, and whatever. And at the very end of Uncharted 3, they walk off together, and I always thought that was quite a nice way of doing it. It's like they go off into their future together, and I always love the as the credits roll in Uncharted 2, it's just all on the chemistry of the two characters, and it's like, yeah, that should be more important, or it can be more important than just showing people getting together by default just because we have the two main characters kind of thing.
Yeah, it's way better than the you know, because I feel like married couples in games is a recipe for like, oh no, my wife died, and now I'm motivated to kill people. So, yeah. You know, that's it's always good when that isn't the case and a healthy relationship is actually, you know, depicted. You could mention, like, you know, John and Abigail from Red Dead 2.
Yeah, shout.
But yeah,
it's not that much when you really think about it. Like you said, most of the time it's motivation or it's something that happens at the very end of the game or whatever. But I love Geralt and Yen's chemistry. I love how much Yen just grounds Geralt and just sort of tries to bring him in. Whereas like, it depends how you want to play that character. But I really like that chemistry.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Question from Rex Wolfley, who says, with the current state of live service games, would it be better to just take the voice performances from Suicide Squad and pivot into a DC animation project instead? Would hate for this game, as it currently looks, to be the last performance for Kevin Conroy.
Yeah, it's a shame that it's panned out this way. I feel like there was a version of this game, and obviously it isn't, I think we should make the clarification here that it isn't a live service game. It is a co-op game primarily.
Right, it's now like, they're apparently overhauling it, yeah, to remove. Yeah,
so it's basically a co-op story game. In a similar way to the way Gotham Knights was, where you had certain live service elements integrated. but it was a co-op story. And again, in Gotham Knights' case, I think this is a good point about like contextual, like sometimes live service elements would have worked. If they'd, that Gotham City that they built for that game would have been perfect to plug in certain events and things into. And the DLC they ended up going with was like a horde mode type raid thing, which is, again, it was fun to play, but just not... You know, the great thing about Gotham Knights is like, oh, I'm getting to patrol this great Gotham City and crimes will come up and I can interrogate people and find clues and stuff like that. That's how I would have done it. But Suicide Squad, I think presentation-wise, like, there is a lot of good stuff here, but also I think tonally it's quite antithetical to the universe that Rocksteady has created. It's very irreverent, quite Deadpoolian. Obviously there is some funny stuff in there. I laughed so much at the reveal trailer where King Shark is seeing Superman in the sky and he's like, it's Superman, he's actually going to save those people, and then he kills them. Personally, it's difficult for me to talk about this because like the Batman Arkham games are so deep and personal to me, and this game is pretty much like nothing that I would never have wanted this from Rocksteady. I'm sick to death with evil Superman stories in general. Like, right. And again, you know, we were talking again, plug in the Wind Up podcast, I think, talking about how game development cycles means that developers are capitalizing on trends pretty much at sometimes they can lead to a situation where you're capitalizing on a trend that has since died out. Tonally, I think that's the case of Suicide Squad as well as the gameplay sort of things, because I think everyone in general, like, is fed up with evil Superman stories that we had in Justice. We had dark red eyes Henry Cavill in, I'm making him sound like a Yu-Gi-Oh card, in Justice League. And now, obviously, with the James Gunn and Peter Safran universe, they're leaning into the idea of Superman being a hopeful, optimistic hero, which I think is how he should be presented. I don't know. I think it's just difficult to get excited about this because we had the Suicide Squad tease at the end of Arkham Origins, which was a WB Games Montreal title. They were going to do, allegedly, they were going to do a Suicide Squad game of their own. That reportedly got cancelled. And it just feels like Warner Brothers were like, Rocksteady, do Suicide Squad. And everything that I just look at this...
You'll make it work.
It doesn't feel like that. And it, again, like, it is a shame that this is Kevin Conroy's... I'm sure that he's done an amazing job in it. And like the voice acting overall, it sounds wonderful in the game. And like presentation-wise, that's all good.
Timeline-wise... Mm-hmm. Sorry, just like a timeline wise, this is meant to be the same Bruce from the end of Arkham Knight who survived.
There's so many weird questions about this. Like, is at the end of Arkham Knight, obviously, spoilers for an 8-year-old game there, but at the end of that, Bruce Wayne fakes his death, and then it's revealed in a post credit sequence that he is taking on a new mythological version of Batman. And there's loads of stuff here where I could go into a whole rant about this. It's probably worth doing an editorial about this.
We should do a video on it.
If you're ever down for it, because the way the Batman Arkham series started off, it was like Paul Dini, who was one of the brainchilds of Batman the Animated Series in the 90s. It was very much his thing. There were certain, obviously, huge, almost 90s Legends of the Dark Knight comic influences here, but mostly it was made in that BTAS mold. You had Conroy back, you had Hamill, you had Arlene Sorkin, who has also since sadly passed away. You had Tara Strong. And in Arkham City, like, Paul Dini set up a bunch of stuff that was ongoing in the comics that he was writing at the time. So you'll recall that in Arkham City, you can find Hush, and he's got Bruce Wayne's face. That was an arc that Paul Dini had written in the comics a few years prior to... literally just a year before Arkham City had come out. And then you get to Arkham Knight, and it's almost like Paul Dini wasn't involved in that. He wasn't asked to return, as far as I'm aware. I think he spoke about that. And then you have Rocksteady dovetailing into what I think is quite a cliched and rote depiction of the character, and leading into cliches like, oh, the Bruce Wayne is just a mask, Batman is who he is deep down, and he comes away and he becomes Batman. So I think at this point in time, I'm just concerned about and tired of this depiction of the DC mythos. So to answer the question in a really long-winded way, me personally speaking, I think there is a lot in Suicide Squad that looks on an aesthetic level... I can see a lot of hard work and effort has been put into this version of the DC universe. It's just not my cup of tea, as Spike Lee would say.
No. It's one of those things as well where, like, I know it's more on the Marvel side, but one of the stories that broke across the last couple of days was that the Daredevil writers have all been let go from the Born Again TV show, and the general sort of write-up that behind the scenes when it comes to Marvel, only now are they appointing showrunners and appointing creative leads to be able to lead the various projects. And to me, that felt like it spoke to the feeling that a lot of us have had for a good few years now of the studio executives are leading the fray. Like, just do this. This is the thing the kids like. Just do this. This will make all the money. And there's not really a backbone backbone or an integrity to any of those things. And I wouldn't be surprised if that was along the way what led to the... And I know that this particular Suicide Squad game has been in development since 2013, if you go all the way back, the idea of a Suicide Squad game. But it's just one of those things where it just feels so nakedly trying to be for the kids. Like, even the way that the characters move is very Fortnite. Yeah, and it's just it just is that thing. And so I think, you know, because it's been in development for so long, it is just part of a bygone era. And it'll to me, I'll be amazed if it doesn't go the way of the Saints Row reboot. But I guess we'll see what happens. In regards to Kevin Conroy, like you said, Ewan, like his performance will be the probably the best thing in it. But I think most of the character writing and everything will... I guess the performances side of it will be solid. But yeah, it's a weird thing. I think at this point, at least for me, just get it out and we can get past it. And maybe there are salvageable elements of it. But their decision to delay it a whole year and try and gut it and change the genre.
I don't see how you've got the skeleton and musculature there. I'm not sure how much you can rejig that to be anything. Like, and again, like, not to go off on about it because I've spoken about it before, but like, giving them all guns. He's called Captain Boomerang. He's not called Captain Gun.
Captain Gun.
King Shark. I want to bite people as King Shark. I don't want to be using like guns and stuff. It just feels like you're shoehorning in DC characters into a different game.
It's very Avengers as well, where it was like, we need to have a set of skills, like giving like Hulk a ranged attack or whatever, giving Kamala Khan a ranged attack. So she just, her palm just goes way out into the distance.
At least they committed to their powers there. Like, playing as the Hulk in Marvel's Avengers, I felt like I was playing as the Hulk. Captain America's shield stuff was all really fun. Iron Man had a lot of cool abilities. And even if they could do a lot of the same things together, they were still using abilities that were their powers. Like,
that's very true. I just meant it ended up becoming like limiting for the levels, because it was like everyone needs to be able to get through here. But yeah, we'll see what state that thing arrives in next year. Question from KTM421, who says, afternoon, hope all is well. Question for me, for Scott, is what's my thoughts and out of 10 for Assassin's Creed Mirage? And also, is Ubisoft showing that you can really... Is Ubisoft showing that you can still make a good and enjoyable 15 to 20 hour story experience for a lower price than the massive 100 hour stories that we get for £70? I'm still playing through Mirage. I'm about 15 hours in. I think it's awesome. Like, I think it's exactly what I wanted it to be. It is very standard for an Assassin's Creed story. It is literally just Basim finds the hidden ones. It's before they're called the Assassin Order and everything. Gets recruited, becomes an assassin, and then at least that's as much as I've done so far. And from general discourse around the game, it seems that's pretty much it. Apart from apparently at the very end they start tying things back into Valhalla, which was in itself very over the top, especially when it came to Basim and the main characters. But that's, I don't, like, I'm fine with a game that I can finish in a weekend or a game that I can finish in a week, and something that feels focused and just feels like everyone who was on board knew what they were making. It's categorically the opposite of the Suicide Squad game, and it's very, very simple, and it harkens back to the mid sort of 2000s and late 2000s and the 360, the PS3 era, where we got so many of those games that just knew what they were from beginning to end, and I'll personally take that. And so it's one of those things where it is very much the 2007 original Assassin's Creed with the gameplay additions of the specific things from Syndicate, Unity, etc. But personally, I'm there for it. I've been with Assassin's Creed since the beginning, and I'm happy that they're just doing one like that. Even though you just have to add the little caveat that it is glorified DLC, and chances are the next Assassin's Creed will be more like Odyssey, Origins, Valhalla again. But yeah, out of 10 for now, I mean, it's probably like a 7 or an 8. Like, I just, it's not doing anything wrong. My overall golden rule is just, what were they going for? What did they nail? And they nailed everything in regards to doing a throwback Assassin's Creed. So I can't really point, you know, many issues at it. If you like the original, you'll like this. But yeah, overall as well, I mean, what's your thoughts on, because I mentioned like before the idea that I would take so many more smaller installments. Do you like this as a potential model for the industry?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm one of those guys who really hated the new direction that Assassin's Creed went in. I think that Syndicate is probably the most unfairly maligned game in history because it didn't stand a chance after the bollocking that Unity took. Which is a shame, because I think Syndicate is one of the strongest games in the series, one of the most immaculate, historical recreations that they had there with Victorian London. And I think there was a place for that gameplay formula. I know other people disagree, but Assassin's Creed to me was never going to be like an RPG where you have to hit people and their numbers will go down, or you can't hit this guy because his numbers aren't right or whatever.
I was going to say, when they made it so that stealth kills had to be level-based, which thankfully they've taken away in Mirage, but yeah, that was the turning point.
I think it's just, I want to see more of this from Assassin's Creed. It's not good. Again, I haven't picked it up. It's going to be something I'm going to wait to come down in price even more, just because it seems like there's a lot of games coming out recently that I feel like I can wait a little bit longer for, and I can get them when they come down a little bit. But Yeah, like I think we need more stuff like this. I think that, like you mentioned before, like it's a case of, you know, we're totally down for shorter experiences that are more digestible. Mm-hmm. I never want to hear the words "it gets good after 18 hours" in someone's review ever again, because that is just obscene. That's a massive amount of time sink to think that, okay, well, the first 18 hours were a complete bore, but you know then it gets really good at the end, and no one wants
once you've
that.
Stockholm syndromed yourself in, yeah, and it's like, well, I'm here now, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
There's ways to do it. I think for Assassin's Creed, like you said, it had this insane sort of shift where they just started making Witcher games. And we had three Witcher games. I really like Origins. Odyssey's great to a point. I think Cassandra's the best character they've had in that whole trilogy. Although Bayek is awesome as well. But it's just that halfway through Odyssey, it just becomes ridiculous. They just throw the story out the window and start doing ludicrous things with time powers and everything else. But it's one of those things where if you grew up on Assassin's Creed and you quite like that mix of old and new, Mirage is very much the old. It's just sticking to one time period. It's all set in Baghdad, at least so far. But I think there is a franchise identity there that they've kind of pulled it and stretched it and made it really thin and weird. But I think there is always something there. Like it is a cool IP when done well. The idea of just assassins through time is a cool idea. Question from Nelson Fowler, who says, I haven't heard a podcast or seen a video with us talking about Baldur's Gate 3. Would love them thoughts and explanations on that game, video or podcast. When I'm further through it, that game doesn't end. I'm like 35 hours in. I'm in Act 2. The main channel's Adam Strawn is like begging me to finish this. We can talk about it on a podcast. I'm thinking that's when I'll do it. At the minute, because the game is so humongous, Jules won't touch it. He's like, I'll never work again if I start playing that thing. I'm kind of just waiting for someone to bounce stuff off. But I still need to get through it. So where I am at the minute, I'm in the Underdark. I know fans will know that. And I'm just doing loads of stuff with some prison tower, and I don't know what's going on anymore, Ewan. I've got to get a thing out of my head, but now we're talking about overthrowing a throne room. I don't know. I'm doing that, and then at some point I'll hit the credits, and then I'll have things to say. But game is phenomenal. Game is brilliant. It's the most game of the year, and I guess we'll see how things shake out when it comes to the Game Awards and everything. But huge, huge fan. Question from Steve, who says, don't know what it is, but Deftones have stole my heart this year. Yes, I know I'm late to the party, but they're insane. That said, what are our takes on Deftones, and what band has swept us off our feet across 2023? Now, mine is what you would call George Ezra on with riffs, which is Sleep Token. I love me some Sleep Token, but you can't deny the Ezra-isms in Vessel's voice.
Scott, I love you. I don't see it with the Sleep Token guy. Oh, I can't get behind it.
You got to worship, mate.
Yeah. I mean, Deftones' opinions, it's kind of like a band that I've really ever gotten into. There's always been like kind of like a cursory, oh, Deftones are on. I like that. I'm not going to like fully commit to it or whatever, but same, like, you know, I'm enjoying them. Like in terms of bands.
I'll shout out though, just to throw in the Deftones pile. Cause yeah, I've never got that on board with Chino Marino's vocals. Like I get the vibe, but for me, it's all about the riffs. I'm a lyrics are last person. I'm all about composition, instrumentation, riffs, whatever. So I'll shout out Swerve City. I forget what it's from Koino Yokan. I think that came out in like 2013-ish. But that is a bouncy riff ass song.
I mean, in terms of bands that have like blown me away this year, I've not really been, my memory recall is so bad now. But what I will say is that like I made some old discoveries this year. I rewatched a movie called Midnight Run at the beginning of the year, which great movie if you haven't watched it already. It's directed by the fellow who did Beverly Hills Cop. It's a comedy movie with Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin. It's fantastic. Joey Pants is in it too. The soundtrack was done by Danny Elfman. And they have a song at the end of it called Try to Believe, which is by his band Oingo Boingo. And that kind of set me off on a massive Oingo Boingo deep dive. And now I love Oingo Boingo. I'm kind of obsessed.
I didn't even know that was a thing. Danny Elfman has a band called Oingo Boingo.
Yeah, Oingo Boingo. Okay. And Scott, let me tell you, the music really does oing and boing. they did the song for Weird Science as well, which is kind of like a banger. But Dead Man's Party, that's like a fantastic Private Life. They've got some really, really, really good songs. that I would definitely recommend checking out.
Yeah, I noticed this morning as well, just speaking of music, so we have a music channel, but we haven't got many outlets for it. So if I get the opportunity to talk about music, I'll take it. There's a new Bring Me the Horizon song today, and Spirit Box have new stuff as well. So just all of those who celebrate those bands, there's new Beartooth album as well. Go check that, those things out. Last question from Jack Jingle, who says, recently watched a video which really struck home the importance of mental health awareness. He linked it as well, so I went over and checked it out. It's on the Norwich City Football Club channel. They did it for Mental Health Awareness Day. And Jingle says, do you find that gaming boosts your mental health? It's long since been a happy escapist place for me when things feel overwhelming. Me and you talked about this a little bit, and I think it's one of those things where when I was younger, I've talked on the podcast quite a bit before about how I was bullied loads in first school, middle school, things like that. Very much feeling like you don't matter, very much feeling small. And it's only when you get older that you can articulate that stuff in retrospect. And I think for me, I gravitated to games and getting lost in games and the escapism of them because of all that, because it did give me agency and it gave me ways to interact with worlds that I didn't have for years and years. Now, I had a social circle, I still had friends and everything, but it's just one of those things where your self-worth just isn't there, but you're not fully aware of it until you get a bit older and you think back on it. So for me, I think it's one of those things where, especially we were mentioning music before, a lot of people cite bands and go, oh, I wouldn't have got through school without this band, or I wouldn't have got through this part of my life without this. Mine, it's all gaming for that. I think in terms of a general stability or something, letting me get lost in another world was essential for me to be here, to be honest. But yeah, I still back that though. I think it's like sometimes you just need a game to get lost in. And like, I'm loving the emergence of the cozy genre, all the farming games and things that are like that. I think sometimes when you have a really big day or a stressful day, you can just get lost in a set of mechanics. And there is something about just letting go of literal reality for a bit that at least I've always found to be like hugely replenishing.
Yeah, I need to echo your sentiments there. Like, definitely kind of similar journey for me with video games when I was younger. It'd be kind of like, it was like a great thing that I got to do with my dad growing up and stuff as well. Mm-hmm. And then obviously, you know, as a teenager, we had the great golden age of like the seventh console generation, which was just fantastic to live through being a teenager and not having to worry about like work or responsibilities or anything. I mean, obviously, yeah, there was school and stuff, which my GCSEs and A-levels weren't best pleased with. But, you know, going through all that, like, that was fantastic. I think for me now, it's like, there are certain games that I go to quite a bit and get heavily invested in. Like, I've spoken before about how much I'm into Hell Let Loose. I actually haven't played much of that in the past month because I have been so busy, partially for embargo-related reasons that will become clear next week. But, you know, that's like a big thing for me. I enjoy that. I enjoy the social aspect of gaming. I enjoy finding communities online that aren't toxic and awful. Hell Let Loose is a great example of that. For the most part, I feel it's one of those games where it's kind of something like Dark Souls, where there's so much like unfair death in it that you'll just kind of laugh along with it. Like, you'll be there in prox chat, and it's funny because the way the prox chat is done, that you'll hear someone far away and they're really quiet and they'll get closer to you and they're much louder. So you'll be there as a medic and like on the beaches of Omaha or whatever, and you'll hear a guy being like, medic, medic, and you walk over to him and you'll try and revive him. And then next thing you know, there's like a tank shell that has blown him up in front of you and you're like just covered in blood or whatever. There's something very funny about that, and it'll either work well for people or not. I think for me now, gaming is mostly like a ceremonial thing at times, where I'm like, if I'm really in the headspace to do it, I'll get the blankets out, I'll get cozy, I'll get the gamer juice, which in my choice is Pepsi Max, or I'll get a few brews in or whatever.
Such a shout.
Get some snacks or whatever, and try not to grip up the controller too much, and just sit down and have like a nice little sesh. I find it very difficult to game during the week now. I don't know about you, like, I feel like when I come back from work sometimes, I have obviously need to cook, then you have like all the different house chores to do and stuff. Mm-hmm. I feel like by the time that I'm settled down and ready to actually have a gaming sesh, it's like 8-9 o'clock, which doesn't really leave you that much time, because I don't want to stay up until stupid o'clock in the morning. And I feel like at that point, if I'm gaming, it's like almost like revenge bedtime procrastination, and I'm putting off going to sleep or whatever. So for me, it's like I tend to do it on the weekends now, and that's if I don't have as much going on. But definitely, yeah, like it's still a source of, you know, encouragement when it's not, you know, frustrating me or whatever. And it's just nice to play with your mates as well, because like, I've got friends all over the country who I don't get to see very often. I'm originally from Liverpool, so I have a lot of mates back there. I've got my family in Glasgow as well, mates who live in Cumbria. So gaming is kind of an opportunity to just hang out with the boys again and like talk stuff. So yeah,
I think quite a lot of people have that. Yeah, gaming is very good. People have that thing where it is a way to just have like the lobby chat, or the chat in general is just a way to reconnect. It's like, rather than just have a phone call or a DM or whatever, it's like we might as well have a couple of games or something and we can catch up that way. I think that stuff is really like, is understated as how effective that can be, and like maintaining those relationships and everything. But yeah, it's one of those things where it's in terms of how much I'm playing, like I'm playing my Switch on the train, like on the way to work, I'm hopping back on the Switch on the way home. I love having a train game so I can get through something. I should play Train Simulator on the way. I like having those little stints. And then it's like you said, that idea of it being like a little, like a ceremonial thing. Like, I'm going to treat myself to this specific thing. The other week, like looking forward to Mario Wonder coming out, I was like, I'm going to order a cheeseburger and I'm just going to like sit with a glass of Coke and a cheeseburger and play a bunch of Mario. And I think sometimes in my head, I'm like, oh, I'm doing that. And it's like too much of like a set piece thing where I'm like, oh, it's almost like an Instagram photo or something, which isn't being taken, but it feels like that. But sometimes if you get that right and it's genuine, it's like, nah, this is great. Like, you're just getting lost in it for a bit. You haven't got to worry about anything else. Because dusting can just leave me alone. I don't need to be dusting.
Dust, man. Man. Dusting is suck. Why does dust have to get everywhere? And mate, whatever you do, don't get... Any kids listening, don't get Lego. Because it's impossible to dust, man. I'm not even got
Lego
anywhere. But yeah, like dust. Oh, God, I hate dust. Especially the kind of like sticky dust. You know, sticky dust, yeah. Where it's kind of like a little bit clumpy and it's like, oh, you need me to spray you as well to get you to come off the
surface.
Like,
is it a spider? Is it a weird little tumbleweed of dust that's sort of gathered in one of the corners you missed?
And it's even more annoying now with our increasingly finicky consoles that demand to be cleaned so regularly. It's like, oh, please don't. Meanwhile, the Giga Chad Xbox underneath the corner, overheating and getting dusty. It's like, I'm still trucking.
The Series X, it turns itself on to clean itself out at random times. And I think I've got it turned on some setting that lets it do that, but I'll just randomly hear it on.
Your Xbox can go and it like sheds all the dust or whatever.
Yeah, it just sort of just like a little poof
like
in the corner.
Like a chicken has gone down into the vent and a bloom of feathers is coming out.
Yeah. Like it's not like, it's quite like a calm, it's not like that powerful, but it does a thing that cleans itself out every sort of, I don't know, a few weeks or something. Maybe it depends how much
my PlayStation
you use
doesn't
it.
Do that. All it does is just go... sometimes I'm like,
I tell you
stop
what sucks with PlayStation, you know, in the DualSense, how obviously the standard way you would hold a controller behind where your fingers hold, like, because they have all those little divots because the design on the DualSense is all full of the symbols, PlayStation symbols. That's not a nice little set of divots.
Oh.
You know, when all of us sort of realized that there was like gunk in between the little cracks.
Are you gunking?
I'm a gunky boy, yeah. But like all the stuff on the side of a regular controller, yeah, where it's that big long line
big
between the casing. I think it's not necessarily that it's worse on a DualSense, but it gathers, man.
I've not looked
in there.
I mean, I'm afraid to.
I'm telling you, after this podcast, every single person listening to my voice right now should go check the back of your DualSense for gunk. You will find it. World of Goo, it came out in 2014. It's still going. We are the World of Goo. I'm letting you know.
I'm going to have to get one of those little rubbery things where you can, like, it clings stuff, but then DualSense is so finicky, you'll just die anyway.
Some solution to this or something, yeah. And but, you know, on that note, this has been the Entitled Partner Podcast, the EVP, the UBP, the UNBP, and a massive thank you to Ewan for helping out with this in general. Also, a massive thank you to all of you for sending in your various questions and talking points. I've been Scott Tilford, that's been Ewan Patterson.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.